Jetta was now an orphan. Allah, however, did not die in the trenches. She was 39 that year and yearned to live. She was fierce and fearless. She and the others who had fought in the Jewish uprising that spring banded together inside their barracks, and when the Germans came for them with the dogs, they opened fire on the SS. Guards fell to the ground. The casualties first stunned the German officers, and then they turned murderously furious. There was nowhere to run inside the barbed wire of Poniatowa. The Jewish fighters weren't interested in running anyhow. The Germans set fire to the building and torched the barracks. Alla and her friends died inside, trapped in the blaze but still resisting. In those final hellish moments, as the world exploded in flames around her, she surely thought of her husband, Arik, perhaps still somewhere out there fighting, and of her precious little daughter in hiding. For Irene's circle of friends, the winter of 1943-44 was a killing season. There was no way to look on the bright side during those months. It was loss after loss. That the children were safe was the only possible consolation. By the second week of November, as the ripple effects of the laundress's denunciation of Irene spread through the network, there was more bad news. Now, in the cells at Pavyak, Irene caught sight of a beaten and brutalized Helena Šeško. Helena's role as a nurse and courier in the network was a crucial one. Helena was, Irene always said, full of initiatives, and she brought to their underground network dozens of contacts in hospitals and clandestine circles across Warsaw. Would Helena be strong enough to stay silent, too? Like Irene, Helena held in her hands the lives of Irka Schultz, Jadwiga Denica, and Vladislava Marinovska, and the lives of hundreds of children in the orphanages. The women were herded together each day to the courtyard for daily walks at Pavyak, and sometimes she and Helena exchanged a careful glance, a look of solidarity and determination. However, Helena's husband and their collaborator, Leon, the man who had arranged for children to be smuggled out through the Muranov streetcar and saved so many, was beyond reach already. He was shot in a public execution by firing squad on November 17th. The next to fall was Jadwiga Denica. The network was unraveling. On November 25th, Jadwiga was checking in on some Jewish refugees hiding out in a basement safe house and underground press distribution point on Świętojerska Street in the Zolibosz district when the Gestapo raided. Jadwiga was 24 that year, and it was only because she did not break during the torturous interrogations at Pavyak, where she now joined her comrades in arms in the cells, that Katarzyna Meloch and dozens of other children were not discovered. Like Alla and Irene, Jadwiga also would not be broken. All the women did their best to keep their spirits up in prison, despite the constant aching hunger and daily abuses of mind and spirit, and despite capricious executions and beatings. Death could come to each of them any morning at roll call. They lived with that knowledge at Pavyak. They also lived with boredom and sorrow. In Irene's cell, some of the women secretly crafted playing cards from scraps of bread and paper, and in the evenings, when the guards retreated and left them all in darkness, the cells often resounded with the sound of sad Polish music, sweet women's voices echoing off the concrete chambers, singing children's lullabies and old folk tunes. Irene and Basha, assigned to the same cell, slept crammed together along with a dozen or more others in the small dank room. But when Basha sang, it felt like freedom. She was one of the most beautiful of all the singers. One night in early December, Basha leaned against the cool cell wall and turned her face away from Irene. Irene was sure her friend was crying. "Basha, what's the matter? Shall we sing something?" she suggested. Basha shook her head slowly and said, "No, I can't sing." She paused. "Irene, they're going to execute me tomorrow. I have a feeling." Irena whispered quiet words of reassurance, but Basha stopped her. No. We saw Zbigniew Wepinski today, coming out of the chapel. He had been beaten. Zbigniew was 18, only a boy, and a courier in the children's underground. Basha and Helena Peshchin watched the guards drag him, limp and broken, along the corridor after interrogation, and Basha berated the young German lieutenant. I gave away that we knew him, Irena. All that night, Irena lay quietly and traced over and over with her eyes the patterns on the ceiling, thinking. Next to her, she knew that Basha was also awake. As they left the cell for roll call at dawn, Basha grasped Irena's hand and squeezed hard. Irena tried not to cry at the roll call. When the names were read out for the morning execution, as Basha had known would happen, she was among them. Basha and Zbigniew were executed that day in a public firing squad at the corner of Ordinatska and Foxhall streets. Irena went carefully through Basha's possessions in the cell that night, and her hand fell upon a small keepsake. It was a small, handmade portrait of Christ, with the words, I trust in Jesus. Irena held it to her, and did not try to stop crying now. For the rest of her life, Irena would guard that small treasure. There were deadly roll calls every morning. On January 6th, they called the name of Jadwiga Deneka. Jadwiga was executed in the ruins of the ghetto, just beyond the prison gates, alongside the 11 Jewish women she had been caught hiding. She had divulged nothing. Irena knew that her turn was coming. In January, Irena was once again called in the morning lineup to the dentist's office, and in the chair, as the drill whirled, Anna Shipovitz handed Irena a last message from Zhagota. It no longer spoke of escape or freedom. It read, Be strong. We love you. In a matter of just another few weeks, it would be too late to get any prison messages to Irena. One day, I heard my name, Irena said. It was January 20th, 1944, the day of her execution. Chapter 15. Irena's Execution. Warsaw, January 1944. They took her to Shuha. The inmates called the death van the hood, and the sturdy canvas cover that left the prisoners unable to look out added to the mounting sense of terror. There were 20, perhaps 30 women that morning, herded by Polish prison guards with green caps and sympathetic looks into the waiting truck for their final destination. Many at Pawiak were summarily executed outside the prison gates, in the ghetto ruins, perhaps on flimsy boards above that gaping pit of ruined basement foundations. This truckload was destined for the firing squads at Zuha. And although the women were in the dark, they were not spared the knowledge of what was coming. Irena knew this was her final hour. The women were led into a waiting room with doorways on all sides, and most were crying. One by one, a woman's name was called, and she was led to a door on the left that led to a courtyard. One by one came the sound of shots. The sobs in the room grew louder. Irena heard her name called, and that short walk across the room felt like falling. The clock ticking off the seconds seemed strangely loud, and the world narrowed down to footsteps and thoughts of her mother and Adam. She walked left, but the guard signaled to her to take the door on the right. Further interrogation. Irena's heart sank. She wanted the torture to be over. She had no doubts about how this would end. Inside the room was a Gestapo agent in his tall black boots, a florid-looking German. Come, he instructed her. Irena followed. He led her out into the thin winter sunlight. Irena wished for cyanide to end this gently. Would he shoot her at the crossroads, like so many others? He led her now away from Pawiak, toward the parliament buildings, and at the intersection of Aleja Vizvolenia and Aleja Zhuha, he turned to her. "You are free. Save yourself fast." Irena's mind stumbled to process the information. Free? She couldn't register at first the word's meaning. All she could think next was that there was no way to live in occupied Poland without identity papers. "My Kenkarte," Irena insisted. "I need my Kenkarte. Give me my papers." Rage flashed in the German's eyes. "You lousy thug, get lost," he snarled, and he pounded his fist into her mouth with fury. Irena's mouth filled with blood, and she staggered away, dizzy. When she looked back, the German was gone. She stumbled. A stranger on the street turned to look and hurried past. She was too bloodied and bruised to go far, and her half-healed bones were not sturdy enough for running. "I could not go on," she said later, of those first few moments. "I went into a nearby drugstore. The owner took me to the back room, where I washed, and she gave me a few pennies for the tram ticket. The owner's name was Helena, and she gently bathed Irena's shattered face and found something to cover her telltale prison uniform." Irena admitted afterward that it was foolish, reckless and stupid even, but she couldn't think of anything to do except go home to her mother. She boarded the number 5 streetcar in the direction of Vola, stunned and frightened. Suddenly there came a cry from one of the teenagers on the streetcar, and everyone rushed for the doorways. "Gestapo at the next stop! Get off quickly!" The Germans were checking papers ahead. Women with shopping bags and men in limp fedoras rushed past her and disappeared into the crowds, but Irena was half-crippled and slow-moving. An old man with sad eyes turned and stopped and waited for her. She wanted to cry for gratitude when he offered her his hand to help steady her as she stepped from the platform. The intensity of his sorrowful gaze said that he knew she was in the resistance. Irena stepped from the streetcar and disappeared quietly into the crowd, trying not to stumble. Her broken leg burned with a white pain, and she willed away the darkness that nibbled at the edges of her consciousness again. How easy it would have been to faint away and let oblivion carry her. When she arrived home at last, she was hardly able to stand. The limp would stay with her forever. "I was so naive," Irena said afterward, "that I spent several nights at home, in the same apartment where the Gestapo had arrested me." Across the city that afternoon, trucks with bullhorns blared out the names of those executed that day for crimes against Germany, and posters tacked to billboards announced her death in bold letters. "Obfiscenie, Irena Sendlerova, 20 January 1944. Crime, providing aid to Jews." Sooner or later, someone who had seen that poster would realize that she was still living in the apartment, and the Gestapo would come looking. That realization slowly dawned on Irena. Staying was too dangerous, but leaving was impossible. Her mother, Janina, was dying. She had suffered for years from a heart condition. A daughter in Pawiak and nights of endless worry had taken a worse toll, and Irena struggled with guilt and remorse. However unwittingly, what other conclusion was there except that she was responsible? In the day or two after her release, another thought nagged at Irena. Why had they set her free? Was it some kind of trap? Her first worry was what would happen if one of her liaisons, nearly all of them friends, came near her now. But soon a note came from a young courier who immediately scampered off. When she saw her code name, Yolanta, she had her answer. Zhegota had arranged it. Zhegota wanted her to leave the apartment now. She knew the safe house location. But Irena couldn't go. She couldn't leave her mother. Another message came. Julian Grobelna tried to warn her. Janka came and pleaded. Irena put it off. It meant disappearing. A cousin who had come to nurse Yanina during the months of Irena's incarceration promised to stay on. Everyone urged Irena to flee. But Irena couldn't bear to leave her mother. She moved the next night into the apartment of a neighbor one flight up, who agreed to let her stay there just for a short while. Hiding in a place so nearby meant that, for a few minutes each day, Irena could slip down the stairs to see her mother. Even this was a foolish gamble. She was inviting disaster, and Yulian was growing impatient. One night in the last week of January, that disaster struck. Just after the 8 p.m. curfew passed, when the streets were quiet and the Gestapo raids started, the tramp of heavy boots once again filled the staircase of the apartment building, and Irena heard voices with German accents shouting. Her heart froze. She knew what it meant. The Gestapo had realized she was missing. They were searching the building. Doors slammed on the first floor. Irena looked around the small apartment hopelessly. A closet? The bed? There was no point in hiding. It was stupid to die like this. Stupid! She could not believe she had been so foolish. She knew that this time it would kill her mother. The look on the face of her stricken neighbor told her that the woman understood for the first time that it was her own death sentence as well. "We died inside from fear," Irena said simply. I do not know how long it took. Minutes seemed like an eternity, until we heard the sound of running shoes moving away, Irena said later. When the corridors were quiet again, a tap came on the neighbor's door, and Irena's cousin passed her a message and quickly embraced her. Goodbye. You must go, Irena. And then she turned and retreated down the hallway. Irena held the thin sheet of paper, and her hand was shaking. She read her mother's heart-wrenching message. They were looking for you again. You must not come near, even to say goodbye to me. Get out as soon as possible. The Gestapo had searched all the lower floors of the building. They had stopped just one floor below where Irena was hiding. Irena relented at last. What other option was there if it meant the murder of her mother? An awful knowledge crashed upon her now. She had been a terrible daughter. Yulian Grobelna swiftly arranged Irena's new identity papers, and the woman who had spirited thousands away to safety would herself now go into the deepest hiding. For a short time, while she was healing, she was allowed to stay with Yulian and Halina and Adam in Otvotsk. But staying in one place for long was not an option for a woman who had now shot to the top of the Gestapo's most wanted list. And for Adam's safety as much as her own, she had to keep moving as soon as she was able. With her stunning escape came the belated realization at Shuha Avenue that she had not been a small player in the resistance. The Gestapo hunt for Irena was on. Irena's new papers gave her a fresh identity, and suddenly, like the thousands of children she had helped to save, there were a dozen new details for her to learn completely. Her name now was Klara Dombrowska. Irena dyed her hair red as a disguise, and in home army files on her, there was a description of her as she looked then. About 160 centimeters tall, slender, with a slightly aquiline nose, bright blue eyes, and a short haircut. After the first few weeks, Irena moved constantly. There were other safe houses in Otvotsk. She stayed for a time with her uncle near Novi Sanj. When things got too hot, she spent some time back in Praga as a hidden resident at the Warsaw Zoo, where some of the Jagoda leadership, including Dr. Adolf Berman, had gone underground in the autumn of Irena's arrest. Moving was a fact of life in this dangerous evasion, but Irena missed her mother and Adam. In Otvotsk, Irena learned at last the heroic story behind her 11th-hour rescue. When Yanka brought the news of Irena's capture to Adam and Mario Kukulska at the apartment in Praga, all three were wildly determined to save Irena. At the safe house in Otvotsk with Yulian, Adam's grief and worry was a constant reminder. Yulian promised that Shigota would supply any sum needed to bribe the Gestapo if such a thing could be done. For Irena's release, they paid the highest ransom ever in their history as an organization. No one knows quite how high the figure was, but it was something close to 35,000 zlotyk, the equivalent today of more than $100,000. But could it be done, at any price? Only a bribe at the highest ranks of the Gestapo could bring about such a brazen prison break. And who among them had those kinds of contacts? The obstacle was finding someone with contacts close enough to the Gestapo to make it happen. You didn't just go up to Germans on the street and start asking, especially not if you were a Jewish man in deep hiding. What the friends needed was someone Polish, and someone with connections inside the Gestapo. What they needed was someone like Irena's office conspirator, Maria Palester, with her weekly bridge games. Several years now into the German occupation, Maria amiably chatted up Gestapo informers each week, and more than once had used her charms in the service of Irena's network. She had an extensive network of contacts in the underworld, but there was no way to minimize the risk Maria was taking now to save Irena. She was calling in her chips and risking the lives of her family. After all, Maria's Jewish convert husband, Henrik, was no less in danger now than when the war had started. Her teenage son, Christoph, was in an elite resistance squadron and in constant danger. And the family was still helping to hide Jewish friends in their apartment. But Maria did not balk at a bold gamble. Irena had made it possible for her family to survive. If she could, she would now save Irena. Maria reached out to a friend who reached out to someone else. Somewhere along the way, a bargain was struck, at last, with the German officer who took Irena to the crossroads on the morning of her execution. Lured by the fantastic sum, he agreed to enter in the official records that Irena Sendler had been executed. The drop-off was the stuff of cloak-and-dagger spy novels. Finding someone to deliver a bribe to the Gestapo was a fantastically high-risk proposition. Maria's 14-year-old daughter, Małgorzata Palester, undertook the operation. She calmly carried the rolls of cash, buried in the bottom of her school backpack, to the rendezvous with the courage of a seasoned resistance agent. It would have been an easy thing to take the cash and shoot the girl on the street. Germans answered few questions when it came to Polish corpses. He might have taken the cash deposit even more easily and still led Irena to her execution. For whatever reason, he didn't. Adam now explained to her another secret. Zhigota had gone to such lengths to free Irena, a single agent in a large and sprawling network with 100 different cells, in largest part because of the lists of children. While Irena thought she had been keeping the lists to protect the children, it turned out that the lists had saved her life also. Zhigota sent me letters so that I would be assured that they were doing everything possible to get me out, Irena recalled. But all the prisoners got these letters. Sure, Julian Grobelne and Adolf Berman, the organization leaders, cared for Irena and Adam personally. But their great efforts to keep me alive were due to something greater than sentiment, Irena now realized. They knew that if I died, the only trace of the children would die too. The index was the only chance of finding the children and returning them to Jewish society. And Zhigota did not know that my liaison officer hid the index. They only knew from my letters that the Germans did not find the index. What to do with the lists now? It was another pressing question, as members of their cell kept falling into the clutches of the Gestapo. Janka was still hiding the tissue paper rolls that Irena had tossed to her the morning of the arrest. But there were other parts of the list also stashed away for safekeeping. What if Irena were again arrested? What if something happened to Yanka? Yanka's husband, Yusef, was a resistance soldier in the home army, and their home was exposed and vulnerable. The lists needed to be gathered together and hidden properly. In the winter of 1944, Irena and the two sisters, Yaga and Yanka, now agreed on a new location. They buried their papers in a bottle under the apple tree in Yaga's wild backyard on Lekarska Street. Irena was living on the run, and she could wait a little while longer to be with Adam if that was how to keep him safe. But breaking her ties with her mother was impossible. Yanina did not have much time left. She was dying. And the Gestapo knew it. Irena's old Wola apartment, where Yanina still lived, was under surveillance, and the trap was set to spring on Irena. She now struggled with the realization that she had risked her mother's life at every moment, but only in hindsight did Irena see how great the danger had been. She stayed away, but it felt like a betrayal. Irena pushed those thoughts away. Stopping to rest now felt like failure. Within weeks after her release, despite her badly healed bones, she returned to dangerous underground work as Clara. She was determined to continue delivering her support funds to the families and checking in on her children. There is no record of the precise visits Irena made in the winter of 1944. Although she and Adam kept careful records of all her children, those account books would not survive the coming tumultuous summer of 1944 in Warsaw. But it is almost certain that she made one of her first trips to the Ochota district to visit her old friends Zofia Wendrychowska and Stanislav Papuzinski, and to check in on three of her Jewish children, including her favorite, Estera. Ochota was still more of a village than part of the city in the winter of 1944, and Zofia and Stanislav's house, number 3, was the last home in the development there, before Matvitska Street gave way to fields and farmland. Stanislav worked in a medical clinic and traveled each day to the old town of Warsaw, but Zofia was a public librarian in the neighborhood. There was a willow tree swing in the overgrown backyard, and bright flower gardens that Zofia tried to tend amid the flurry of more than a half dozen children. When Irena came up the front step, they greeted her with a chorus of happy screams, because Pani Irena was a favorite. Zofia and Stanislav had five children of their own, a son, Marek, who would turn 13 that year, 10-year-old Eve, 9-year-old Andrei, 4-year-old Joanna, and an infant born just that year named Tomas. Often when Irena came, Zofia was away working, and then the children's grandmother greeted her warmly and offered her tea and cakes, the ubiquitous gesture of Polish welcome. Along with an older man in the neighborhood, Mr. Sikieri, their grandmother looked after all the children on the street when the parents were working. And there was a tribe of them, children with names like Sławek, Julia, Adam, and Hania. There were also the 4 or 5 Jewish children whom the family was hiding for Irena and for Dr. Redlinska's network. The eldest among them was Teresa Tucholska, Estera, who acted the part of a little mother to baby Tomas. It was great luck that Irena was not visiting on the afternoon of February 22, 1944, a blustery winter Tuesday. That day, tragedy struck the family. Stanislav was out of the house, perhaps at work at the clinic, or perhaps, some say, at a clandestine meeting of the resistance. But Zofia was at work, and there were so many little ones underfoot that the older children on the street, mostly boys who were 13 and 14, were left to their own devices. The boys went out into the barren fields behind the house to play at being resistance fighters. The children may even have had a gun. They had certainly absorbed the silent lesson from their parents that it was brave to fight the Germans. Like Irena, Zofia and Stanislav both still worked in the underground with their old professor, and their sister-in-law, Halina Kuchkovska, was a senior underground operative. While the neighborhood boys were playing at killing the occupiers in the fields, some actual Germans spotted the youngsters, and the boys howled with glee at the adventure. But the Germans gave chase for real, ordering them to surrender. Pursued by German soldiers, the children were too frightened to stop, and they ran for home. The first home on the street belonged to Marek's parents, Stanislav and Zofia. The boys clattered through the front doorway. The Germans stormed the threshold behind them. Inside the house there was a fight with the soldiers. Little Eve hid under the bed crying. The Germans chased the boys in a hail of gunfire. A bullet hit one of the older boys, wounding him badly, and he fell with a cry in the stairwell. The other children jumped out of the window and fled to the fields, and the soldiers gave chase. But, of course, it was only a matter of time before they returned for the boy and his parents. When a frantic neighbor fetched Zofia from the library, the Germans were gone, and the children were terrified. They watched wild-eyed as Zofia tried to stop the boy's bleeding and started quickly burning sheets of papers. Zofia's first thought was to hide the children in the attic. She knew the police would be coming soon with reinforcements from the Gestapo. Then she thought better of it. Turning to the children, Zofia put Estera in charge. "You must take them to my friend's house on Krucha Street," she told Estera. Estera knew the one. "Go quickly. Do not come back. I'll come to get you." Estera fled with the little ones immediately. Zofia stayed with the bleeding child and found him a spot in the attic to hide in. But the stairs were covered with his blood, and she had to remove the trail that led right to him. While a neighbor tried to tidy up the ruined living room, Zofia got on her hands and knees with a pail of water and started to scrub the blood away. That was where the Germans found her when they stormed the house, on her knees, scrubbing and crying. She had not been able to complete the job before their arrival. A German soldier towered over her. He held a gun to Zofia's head and told her to get the boy quickly. On the way to Pavyak, in the back of the van, she cradled the boy for as long as they would let her. But he was dead before they reached Shuha Avenue. Zofia, whom the Gestapo had on their list of those they wanted to interrogate for other reasons, was taken inside alone for questioning and torture. When Stanislav heard, he turned to Irena, their old friend and fellow collaborator. Not only would the Jewish children whom Zofia and Stanislav were hiding for her network need new homes, and quickly, but the Gestapo was searching for Stanislav too. He would have to go into hiding as well. But he couldn't take his own children with him. Would Irena help him? She would, of course, without a moment's hesitation. Irena swung into action and moved Estera to a holiday camp that was hiding Jewish children near the town of Garwolin, some 40 miles southeast of Warsaw. She found homes for the other children in orphanages and in several cases with friends from their pre-war social work network. She turned especially to old contacts from the Polish Free University, more former students of Dr. Radlinska. A number of the youngsters went to the countryside near the village of Anin. Some of Zofia's children ultimately found homes at the camp in Garwolin and in the orphanage in Okęcia with Estera. Stanislav made heroic efforts to have Zofia released from the Gestapo interrogation center and later from Pavyak prison. He reached out to every contact he knew in the home army. But with the children's lives at stake and in hiding himself, it was perilous, and Halina's work in the underground was Zofia's death sentence. Zofia was executed at Pavyak in the spring of 1944, in the same fashion the Germans had intended for Irena. She was in her late 30s. To the end, she also kept silent. Bribing the Gestapo, or trying to, was becoming all too common in their network that spring. Julian and Halina Grobelne owned a small country house with a garden in Segwów, a village not far from Minsk Mazowiecki, and for more than a year the cottage had been used as a Jewish safe house where at-risk children could be hidden away until Irena could obtain new identity papers and make a permanent placement. It was there one day in March that the Gestapo captured Julian, whom they had pegged not as the leader of Zhegota, but as a minor leftist partisan. Now Julian Grobelne was taken to Pavyak and was the one in need of saving. Julian was already hopelessly ill from tuberculosis. Even if he escaped execution, the harsh and damp conditions in the prison were for him a certain death sentence. Irena turned to old friends and once again to Dr. Radlinska's underground circles. Dr. Juliusz Majkowski, the director of the health offices at No. 15 Spokojnia Street, and the man who in the beginning had given Irena, Irka, Jaga, and Jadwiga their ghetto passes, came to the rescue. Working with the medical underground at Pavyak, Dr. Majkowski smuggled extra food and supplies into the prison to try to preserve Julian's precarious health. At last, the prison staff obtained for Julian a medical furlough and a transfer to the Warsaw Hospital, where he would remain a prisoner in a care unit. But the patient never arrived at the hospital. Zhegota, for another immense bribe, arranged for Julian's escape from the ambulance as it roared across the city that morning. Julian's dramatic escape now gave Irena an idea, and she again turned to Dr. Majkowski. By March, the situation with her mother's health was critical. Janina's strength was failing fast, and Irena could not leave her mother to die alone in her old apartment. Would Dr. Majkowski help her smuggle her mother out of Vola? Dr. Majkowski agreed, and a daring plan was made. Dr. Majkowski would come by ambulance to spirit Janina away to a local hospital on a false emergency. Janina's Gestapo watchers would give chase, of course, but in the manufactured chaos, there would be a brief window of a few precious minutes between the time of Janina's arrival and the time it took for the Gestapo to locate her inside the hospital. As Janina was wheeled to a brightly lit room on one of the upper stories, nurses in the medical resistance stood waiting. Helping the frail woman to step out an open window, they assisted her gently down the fire escape. There, in the alley, another ambulance waited with its engine running to ferry her to a Zhegota safe house at the apartment of Stefan Wyszlinski, the widower of Irena's murdered co-worker Stefania. As Irena said later of that desperate adventure, "I had to steal my dying mother from our home and take her to unknown persons until she ended life several weeks later." When Janina died in the days that followed, on March 30, 1944, Irena was there with her. As they sat together quietly on those final days, Janina took her daughter's hand and extracted from her child one deathbed promise. "Don't go to my funeral, Irena. They will be looking for you there. Promise." And Janina was right. At Janina's funeral, the Gestapo was wild with fury. A scowling Gestapo agent accosted friends and family. "Which is the dead woman's daughter?" he demanded. Mourners shrugged.
"Her daughter is in Pavyak prison," they replied.
"She certainly was in Pavyak," came the tight-lipped reply, "but she inexplicably isn't any longer."
By the spring of 1944, Irena was, instead, running her operations from the apartment safe house of her old friends and conspirators, Maria and Henrik Palester. From his hideout in Otwock, where Irena risked capture to see him, Adam fretted. Irena struggled that spring to set aside her grief and threw herself into work with a vengeance. But Adam could see that there was something brittle in her now. It was no wonder. Irena, still only in her early 30s, had lived on the edge of death every day for nearly 5 years. She had buried her mother and more than a dozen friends, and she had survived her own execution. She held in her hands the lives of thousands, and the psychic burden was unbearable.
and from his bedside retreat in Otvotsk, Zhegota leader Yulian Grobelna, too, was giving Irena greater and greater responsibility. She was the general to his field marshal. Irena would not stop. But Adam also knew that she could not go on like this forever. At the weekly Zhegota leadership meetings, it was no longer the leadership delegating to Irena. Irena was, increasingly, setting the agenda. By July, word was coming through underground channels that the Soviet army was approaching from the east. Inside occupied Warsaw, the Gestapo nets were closing tighter and tighter around the resistance, a movement that now included a larger part of the Warsaw population than ever before. The city was on the brink of explosion. In the last days of the month, Irena learned of a group of Jewish refugees fighting for survival in the forests. It was a desperate SOS brought to me by someone who had managed to escape Treblinka, Irena remembered. I presented the problem to the entire Presidium, and the Zhegota leadership instantly authorized Irena to run the dangerous mission of delivering funds for the camp survivors. As always, in Adam's careful account books, which he pored over alone in isolation, he meticulously recorded the figures. I knew that the friend from Treblinka, I cannot recall the names, handed over the money, Irena said, because the next day, before the uprising started, he wanted me to let Zhegota know. Irena also still safeguarded her indexes of the children. She and Yanka knew that a battle for Warsaw was coming. In those final days of peace, the women dug up the lists buried in Yaga's garden, repackaged the entire archive in two glass soda bottles, and under the same apple tree, reburied all the names that since 1939 their network had collected. By the time Warsaw exploded into street warfare on the 1st of August, the lists held the names of nearly 2,500 Jewish children. Chapter 16. Warsaw Fighting. Warsaw, July through December 1944. The general uprising in Warsaw had been planned by the Home Army to begin at 5 p.m. on August 1, 1944, and it was based on a tragic miscalculation. The Germans were losing ground by the summer of 1944, and the Home Army gambled that, in the face of a sustained military revolt, the occupiers would retreat and Warsaw would be liberated. Soviet troops were amassing just outside the city, across the Vistula River in Praga, and they were poised as allies. The Poles assumed that the Soviets would support them, and the Soviets made noises of warm assurance. What the residents of Warsaw could not know was that the Germans, faced with the sweeping advance of the Red Army from the east, had decided to hold Warsaw as a strategic retreat at any cost. The residents did not know, either, that Himmler's orders from Berlin instructed his troops to kill all the city's inhabitants and to bulldoze the entire city. And they did not know, although they might have guessed, that the Soviets had their own divergent political motives, which did not include Polish independence. That summer in Warsaw, there were several resistance organizations ready to do battle in the city, including the remnants of Marek Edelman's Jewish Fighting Organization and any number of small resistance cells. But the Home Army, supported by the Polish government in exile, was the largest and best equipped of the resistance movements. And by July, it boasted a volunteer military corps nearly 40,000 strong in Warsaw alone, out of a population of about 1 million in the city. Among those militia recruits were as many as 4,000 battle-ready young Polish women. The number would grow rapidly in the next few weeks as average civilians joined the battle. For 5 years, the Germans had made it a capital crime for a Pole or a Jew to own a weapon. As a result, there were firearms in the corps for fewer than 3,000. But what the Poles lacked in weapons, they made up for in organization and raw courage. The army had ranks and a chain of command, and districts of the city were divided into orderly fighting units. With the battle for Warsaw looming, and the city anticipating a siege and street fighting, Adam left the hideout in Otwock and joined Irena at last in the Palester's apartment on Wovitska Street in the Mokotov district, sometime in July, in a strange and bittersweet reunion. They naively thought they were safe there, Irena admitted later, and those days seemed like a kind of honeymoon to the young couple. But danger surrounded them, and only afterward did Irena understand that they had been extraordinarily lucky. The Germans, determined to ferret out and crush all resistance, now went from house to house in the neighborhood, searching apartments and demanding identity papers. And somehow they missed the door of the Palester family. The first day of the uprising, Adam and Irena shared in the euphoria that swept across the city. It looked to the residents like a victory of sorts in the beginning. That day and the next, several thousand Poles were killed, and they learned only later that Janka Grabowska's husband, Yusef, had been among them. There were Polish casualties, but the militia had also killed on the first day more than 500 German soldiers, and that counted as success in an occupied city. The home army turned to the Soviets. With the aid of the Red Army, surely the Germans would flee Warsaw, whatever their orders. The Soviets, however, quickly made a cynical strategic decision. Although they were on the side of the Allies by 1944, and the Poles desperately needed support, the Soviets instead retreated to let the Poles and the Germans battle themselves into mutual exhaustion. Ultimately, the Soviets also refused to allow the other Allies, who were slow to act anyhow, to use the airfields outside the city to help the people of Warsaw, even for drops of food and equipment. It was a foolish error of judgment, and the senior leadership in the Home Army realized it quickly. In the words of one general, Władysław Anders, "You can never trust the Soviets. They are our sworn enemies. To hold an uprising whose only success depends on either the collapse of your enemy or help from another enemy is wishful thinking beyond reason." But by then it was too late. Within days, Luftwaffe planes, marked on their underbellies with ominous black crosses, swept over the city in bombing squadrons, and the Poles had no air defense. The bombings would continue without interruption, and, to the despair of the city's residents, on the ground the tide turned just as quickly. By August 5th, the Germans had the upper hand, and troops rampaged through the city, perpetrating the mass murders of civilians. There were stark orders to kill every inhabitant of Warsaw, down to the smallest children. In the next 2 weeks, no fewer than 65,000 residents were executed on the streets. Soldiers entered hospital wards and, row by row, discharged single bullets into the heads of bedridden patients. Some of the worst atrocities took place in the Wola district, just beyond Irena's now empty apartment, where the street fighting was fierce. Buildings exploded in bomb blasts, and tanks rolled down the streets firing shells, crushing under their weight cars and fallen horses and bodies. People quickly gathered together what water and food they could find and retreated to the city's basements to hide. The German governor of Warsaw, Hans Frank, recorded with satisfaction that "almost all Warsaw is a sea of flames. To set houses afire is the surest way to drive the insurgents out of their hiding places. When we crush the uprising, Warsaw will get what it deserves, complete annihilation." As their homes burned around them, and the heavy beams crashed from all directions, residents who were driven from their basements were herded into the open squares at gunpoint and mowed down with machine gun fire. "They drove us from the cellars and brought us near the Sovinsky Park at Ulrihof," said one heartbroken survivor. "They shot at us when we passed. My wife was killed on the spot. Our child was wounded and cried for his mother. Soon a Ukrainian approached and killed my 2-year-old child like a dog. Then he approached me, together with some Germans, and stood on my chest to see whether I was alive or not. I shammed dead, lest I should be killed too. Some of Irena's hidden children and their courageous foster parents disappeared that summer. And there is little doubt that they were among those who perished, after so many had risked so much to save them, in these indiscriminate street massacres. For Irena and her friends, it was all a terrible reenactment of those last days in the ghetto, and the Poles understood at last what it meant to be, in the eyes of the occupiers, Untermenschen, subhumans. Soon the Germans came to the Mokotów district, where Adam and Irena were hiding with Maria and Hendrik Pallister, and began clearing the houses. Like the ghetto, Warsaw was being liquidated and burned, street by street, in preparation for a final cultural annihilation. Adam and Irena fled together, along with a woman from a neighboring apartment, Dr. Maria Skokowska, and a young Jewish woman named Jadzia Pesa Rosenholz, who had been hiding with the Pallister family. But where should they go? Homeless, the friends anxiously debated their next step. One thing was absolutely certain. None of them were about to report, as ordered, to the German checkpoint for deportations. One did not get on trains when the Germans were directing. At last they hit upon a hiding place together in the ruins of a tattered construction site at numbers 51 to 53 Wovitska Street. Huddled in the darkness, they held a quick conference. Hendrik Pallister and Maria Skokowska were both physicians. Irena and Maria Pallister had trained nurses and social workers. The next day they went to work setting up an emergency field hospital for wounded resistance fighters and civilians caught up in the turmoil. The hospital quickly became, like anything Irena put her hand to, a sprawling operation. The need was immense, and unsurprisingly, it was well organized and efficient, despite the almost complete lack of equipment or medicine. Adam, on the other hand, was a lawyer and a philosopher. He would be no use to them wrapping bandages, he told Irena. By that summer he had been cooped up in hiding for 2 years, and Irena understood. He was desperate to be out there fighting in this battle. So Adam threw in his lot with Maria and Henrik's courageous teenage son Christoph and 2 other youngsters, and first they battled the Germans from a nearby cemetery. Adam fought alongside the boys again in the battle for the old town, where they lost 2 of the 3 young men in the action. Christoph Pallister disappeared to rejoin his old Parasol battalion and died in a gunfight in the streets not much later. Adam's heart broke for Christoph's disconsolate parents and little sister. On the streets of the Mokotów district, Irena was now stunned but overjoyed by a different kind of chance encounter. From behind a rubble barricade, a familiar voice called out, "Over here! Over here!" Startled, Irena turned and saw before her a dusty young woman with her blonde hair tucked in a cap, raising in warm welcome an arm on which Irena could plainly see the red badge of the Home Army. "Rahela!" It was Rahela Rosenthal, the Jewish friend whom Irena had thought had died in Treblinka in the summer of 1942. Irena rushed toward Rahela, and crouching behind the barricades together, they embraced, laughing. Irena had counted Rahela among those lost to the Umschlagplatz, but here she was, alive and as beautiful as ever. But Rahela's entire family, including her small daughter, had all perished. She was the last survivor. Rahela shyly looked at Irena, and then turned to introduce her as well to a fair-haired Polish soldier. "My husband." The man grinned and embraced Irena like an old friend. At last Irena turned. "I need to go. I'm at the field hospital." Rahela's husband laughed and told her she had better get going. "We'll give you cover if you hurry." Irena couldn't get over the transformation in her old friend.
She was a totally different person, Irena remembered. She was now a soldier, sharp, determined, fighting with a gun in her hand. Her extraordinary bravery was recognized by everyone in her group. In Mokotov, if the days were hard, the nights were a time of terror. Drunken SS officers made forays into basement shelters and gang-raped Polish women and children hiding there. A German soldier ran his bayonet through Irena's leg when she stumbled upon him, and soon Irena's wound festered from a dangerous infection that made standing agony. Food was running out, and so was water, and civil order was breaking down all around them. At night, Irena lay in the shelter beside Adam, listening to the quiet breathing of Henrik and Maria, and worrying endlessly about the fate of her hidden Jewish children. Many of those youngsters had been moved months earlier to orphanages or rural safe houses as the street-by-street Gestapo searches of attics and basements intensified. But some were still concealed by trusted families in Warsaw. Families who, like all of them in the city, were in unremitting danger. Irena's leg throbbed hotly. Between the pain of her wound and the perils of the streets, delivering support was impossible, and she struggled to make contact with the foster guardians and the children. They were still uniquely vulnerable. Even in the chaos of the uprising, anti-Semitic blackmailers roamed the streets, threatening to denounce anyone who might have a bit of change in their pocket and who looked Jewish. Irena worried about Adam and the girls who lived in hiding with them, and danger seemed to be coming at them from all directions. And it wasn't only in Mokotov, either. Across town, Irena's old friends would later tell the same terrible stories. Stanislav Papuzinski fought in the street battles as a soldier. Yaga Piotrowska rushed into burning buildings during the destruction of her street and pulled to safety unconscious survivors. The razing of Warsaw included the destruction of Yaga's own house, where the lists of children's names were now buried deeper under the rubble in the back garden. By September 9th, the fate of the city was sealed. Luftwaffe planes circled slowly over Warsaw, and the residents looked up from their bomb shelters in basements to see paper leaflets falling. The leaflets fluttered onto rooftops, and people caught them in midair from their balconies. On the thin printed sheets was a final German warning. All residents were ordered to leave the city and report to German processing centers on the penalty of execution. Together in Mokotov, the friends delayed. By now, 30 refugees were hiding in the makeshift medical clinic with Irena and Adam and the Palester family. Among them, 2 young Jewish children. The Umschlagplatz loomed large in Irena's unsettled dreams. She wanted nothing to do with German processing centers. But on September 11th, the Germans arrived on their street with flamethrowers and incendiary devices, intent on burning to the ground every last structure. And there was no longer any option. The air was thick with smoke and dust, and when soldiers discovered them crowded in the basement refuge, the Germans were angry and impatient. Had the resistance fought this long and this hard to be sent now to the concentration camps? They were forced to join a bedraggled convoy of other civilians being marched at gunpoint to the deportation center. They were all in bad shape by this point, but Adam and Henrik were increasingly worried about Irena, who was limping and struggled to keep up. The bayonet wound to her leg had still not healed. It oozed pus, and Henrik worried about sepsis. But Irena wasn't focused on her leg. She was focused on what to do about the young Jewish child traveling with them, a girl named Anna, and how to get them all out of this death procession. In the end, the friends agreed that the best solution was the most expedient. They turned out their pockets quietly and offered a bribe to a German guard if he would send their entourage in another direction. The German considered. There were empty army barracks in Okensha,
out by the abandoned airfields where Soviet POWs and Jews used to be incarcerated, he finally offered, placing the roll of bills carefully in an inside pocket. It will be better if you head in that direction, out of the